Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. This is a very special week because at last, John Sayles has come out with his monumental novel, A Moment in the Sun. It's published by McSweeney's Press, who's done a beautiful book with a wonderfully embossed cover. It's an old style that includes John Dos Passos, and it travels from the American 1890s into the 20th century, beginning with the mining of the Yukon, ending with the electrocution of an elephant, and everything in between. Yellow journalism, Coxey's army, the attempt of Southern white men to reinvent a Declaration of Independence, a white Declaration of Independence, and get their city back in Delaware. It's a rich and complex and thrilling novel. Why this period, John?
I think the thing that drew me into it first was I was doing research for my last novel, Los Gusanos, and which has to do with the long, long dance between the United States and Cuba. And I went back in the research, even though the book doesn't go back that far, to the Spanish-American War to see how the first formal, you know, kind of ground rules were written. And I kept running into this phrase, Philippine Insurrection or Philippine-American War, and had to ask myself, how can I be 37 years old and never have heard of this? Asked some of my Filipino and Philippine-American friends, so what do you know about this thing? And almost all of them said, you know, we kind of know it existed, but it was not taught in our schools back in the Philippines. Certainly not taught in your average American history course. And that gets you suspicious. And suspicion for me is the handmaiden to interest. And I got interested in how did this war disappear? Why is not more written about this? Why is this not celebrated? We won it, didn't we? We usually celebrate wars that we win. And at the same time, I ran into this other incident that happened in 1898 in Wilmington, North Carolina, which was a racial coup. And what I realized, it was the last nail in the coffin of Reconstruction. And I started thinking about, is there a way that these things are linked? The end of Reconstruction and the beginning of not so much America being imperialist, but recognizing it, being proud of it almost, of saying we're up there with the big boys, where we can go and take over another country and have colonies just like the British and the Germans and the French and the Russians and the Japanese and whoever else was in the hunt at that time. And the race, you know, racialization of people's perception of the world was the link that I saw between them. And so I started thinking about, well, how would I get a character who would be in both of those things? And I thought of a character who would, you know, start out as a citizen, African-American citizen of Wilmington and end up in one of the units. And in the case of the book, it's the 25th Infantry, the regulars, which were, you know, colored infantry with white officers who fought both in Cuba in the Spanish-American War and then were stationed in Zambales in the Philippine-American War.
And a wonderful historic diversion, this group, hoping to be in the cavalry, mm-hmm. are given not horses but bicycles to ride because the bicycle is a new invention. And mm-hmm. what will its use be in terms of the mm-hmm. military? Well, why not try it out on the black troops?
Right. And they clunked all the way from Fort Missoula in Missoula, Montana, to St. Louis, mostly not on roads, mostly over fields and railroad tracks and things like that. carrying their rifles in a full pack and a lot of bicycle repair equipment, and you know, sent a report to, I think General Miles got the report first about, well, this is an option. You know, the horse is expensive and takes a lot of care, and you need more than one if you're going to go a long way, and you got to feed them and house them, and the bicycle is not.
Now, you're very familiar with historical research, because my guest, John Sales, well, I hope you all know, he's the director, among other things, of Matawan and Lone Star and Eight Men Out, and fewer but equally passionate will be those who know him as the author of Union Dues or Los Gusanos novels and a wonderful book of short stories, The Anarchist Convention. Research. Where do you find the bicycle? Even for those of us who did know about a war in the Philippines and remember what yellow journalism was, mm-hmm. didn't know mm-hmm. that they tried out the bicycle mm-hmm. for the military. How do you find out?
One of the things that I find with research is, and I think it's even more important now that, you know, people can go on Wikipedia or whatever, is that disinformation is repeated as much as information is repeated. So one of the things that I do when I find research is I look at the date of when it was written, who wrote it, and then I look at their source materials. And then very often you'll find the source material, the same quote, the same incident or whatever. But sometimes it also branches you out. In the case of the Iron Riders, as they were nicknamed, it was just getting the regimental history of the 25th Infantry for that period, and it mentioned, you know, this experiment with the bicycles. And then I started searching in other places, found images of these guys on their trip to St. Louis. Got the names of some of the guys who were in the squad that went down. The white officer who cooked it up was from Louisiana.
A lot of the people going up to mine the Yukon don't even get there mm-hmm. because their equipment is stolen. Mm-hmm. Or they're told they need 200 pounds of equipment if they're going to survive the winter in the mm-hmm. Yukon. And unfortunately, they have only 180 pounds of mm-hmm. equipment, and they still have to buy and buy and buy from whoever is around mm-hmm. or steal to make up the necessary weight. So, John, since we begin this way in this book, what do you think happened to American innocence? Was it ever there?
I don't think it was ever there. I think innocence and ignorance are very close to each other, and there is a kind of willful ignorance. And I think in writing about America, very often the people who wrote about it employed that kind of willful ignorance. And the best way to do that is to limit your definition of what America is and leave out the nasty parts. So you define yourself by your Constitution, and you count black people either as non-persons or three-quarters of a person, you know, and that's a sop, but three-quarters of a person without any rights. You have something like the Alamo, where you say, remember the Alamo, but you leave out the fact that, the freedom that the Texans were fighting for was the freedom to own slaves and get rich. That kind of we as a very small we instead of an inclusive we, that kind of America is this and not that, is a great way to ignore the things that aren't working out, that aren't right.
Now, I think of Howard Zinn's History of America, a great leftist history of America. Was it an inspiration for you?
You know, I don't even think of Howard Zinn's History of America as leftist at all. I think of it as humanist. And I think what Howard did was say, okay, who gets to write the history? They're usually people who are hagiographers. You know, they're biographers hired by the winners. And even if they're not, there's a pressure at the time when you write that history to celebrate what victory you've just had or downplay what defeat you've just had. There is a whole nother history, which are the people who don't get to write it, who just live it. And I think that's a very humanist thing. And, you know, it can be very, very different. One of the things that I found, a lot of the research that I did for this book was in diaries, letters home, accounts of the time written by the guys themselves that they sent back, in the case of the African-American soldiers, to the African-American newspapers. And you not only get some of the style of the way that the people thought and wrote, if not spoke, but you get their point of view on things. And in the same regiment, in the same unit sometimes, you'll find three different guys, one who thinks it's, killing goo-goos is like a rabbit hunt and he's never had a better time in his life. Another who's just trying to be a professional and not think about the political implications, and I shoot at who they tell me to shoot at. I'm here to do a job. And then a third guy who might be horrified by what the United States is doing, what he's being asked to do in the Philippines especially.
Now, we're reminded of the hundreds of words in this book that Americans use for strangers. Mm-hmm. In fact, there are a pair of Irish cops who begin one of the books talking about how bewildered they are, essentially, mm-hmm. in a world that contains anyone except other Mix. Mm-hmm. They're astonishing. Now, racialism mm-hmm. and its language is retrieved in this book. Who is Gugu?
The Gugus were the Filipinos. There's actually – I was in a couple productions of Mice and Men, and there's a point where somebody talks about a Manila Gugu. It was an approximation of we can't understand what they're saying. It's a Gugu language. It altered into Gook during the Vietnam War. But this is the era when even James Weldon Johnson, this incredible African-American, writer and songwriter, was writing coon songs with his brother to make money. That was the coin of the realm.
Yes, you have minstrel shows and all kinds of vaudevilles and hymns here, reminding us again and again that our popular music, even the racist music, was written often by African-Americans mm-hmm. or the targets of the songs, mm-hmm. that we have a nation, in a sense, not of victims but also of volunteers, because it becomes popular. Mm-hmm. It becomes a way of making money.
There were vaudeville stars, African-American vaudeville stars, who wore blackface because that was what you had to do to get a white audience to go and see it. And they obviously didn't need blackface to look African-American. But they weren't being African-Americans on stage. They were being these creatures of entertainment that were a figment of white people's imaginations, and that's what people thought was funny at the time.
And also there's a baseball game where a baseball player, blonde, appears in blackface, I guess because of the searing sun, mm-hmm. but also he starts to pose and posture mm-hmm. the way a black man would. Mm-hmm. And, the black pitcher makes an orange look white, uh-huh. and he throws the ball, and the batter hits, and it explodes in a million orange bits. Mm-hmm. And we're treated to the sense that when it's play, it's playful. Mm-hmm. But when it's between black and white, it's race.
And that the line is very, very close. Most of the humor of that day was ethnic and racial humor. Most of the riots were ethnic or racial riots.
I'm talking to John Sayles, the author of A Moment in the Sun. It's an extraordinary pageant of America that takes us from the American 1890s to the turn of the century to the invention of movies. And it's really something. It's been published beautifully by McSweeney's, who are one of the great, exciting new publishers that America has. It was a book that was regarded as a risk at 952 pages. That's a risk for publishers now, no matter how good the book is. And the book is extraordinarily good. If you're a fan of dynamic writing, this is a book you want to pick up and read and read and read. It lasts a long time, like an all-day sucker. It's a real pleasure. Now, we've got the Civil War recurring, but we've also got the Vietnam War played in small in the Philippines. And we've got the riots around unions as unemployed men try to get to Washington mm-hmm. on the rails. And of course, the moneyed interests don't want the unemployed traveling to Washington on their railroads for free, and we have the American story of Coxey's army. Mm-hmm. Tell it.
Yeah, there was a little Coxey was a guy who just you know, he had this idea that the federal government, if they basically did some road work, you know, they built some roads, they could employ all these guys. It was probably an early version of what Franklin Roosevelt tried during the Depression of let's just get these guys a dollar a day and a place to sleep. There was that bad a depression already on in the 1890s. Coxey, his guys were starting from, I think, Massillon, Ohio, somewhere in Ohio, and they were going to march to the White House. And I think it was Grover Cleveland was the president at the time, and he was going to have to deal with them one way or the other. There was another group who left from Montana, from Butte, who were the mostly members of the Federation of Western Miners, which was an early kind of proto-union. Unions weren't very strong then. And they had twice or three times as much ground to cover to get there and realized they couldn't walk. They couldn't go in wagons. And so they commandeered a train and just telegraphed ahead and said, we're not stopping for anything. And they made it most of the way across Montana, switching engines as they went. The railroad company would empty out all the water so they couldn't put water into the, you know, the engine in order to generate the steam. They would, you know, sabotage the tracks, but they kept going and going and going. And finally, as happened in most of these incidents, it was the American flag that stopped them. They wouldn't fight federal troops. And the federal troops, you know, rounded them up right near the Montana border, and that was the end of it. And most of those guys never worked in a mine again.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with John Sales, author of A Moment in the Sun. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with John Sales about his new book, A Moment in the Sun. It's a historical novel that spans from the turn of the century, the 1890s, Manifest Destiny, to the birth of cinema. And it's so rich and real and intense. The narrative rhythms are so interesting to follow. You'll want to read this book. Now, the writing of this, you seem to know what the colors are mm-hmm. of uniforms, what kinds of weeds grow in different parts mm-hmm. of the country, what the temperature is like mm-hmm. as you travel around in the winter of 1898. Mm-hmm. How does a writer bring things to life in that way? How do you know? Are you making it up? It doesn't feel like it.
No, you do the legwork. You do the research. And what you find is you're going to know a lot more than you're going to put in the book. You're going to want those details. If you were just making it up, you would want certain details to characterize, to give a texture to things, to give a tone to things. And so what you do is you research the details as much as you can. And you can find them usually with some digging. And then what you realize, it's interesting because I also do films. So much of what you do with a frame of a film is try to take things away because you want people to look at a certain thing and not all the other stuff that is there. You know, especially if you're outside, you know, walk outside and there's all the signs and, you know, kind of visual pollution that we have. How do you get rid of that? And now you can do it maybe in post, or you do it by taking a sign down or whatever. In a book, you're only the reader's only going to see what they're going to but what you put there. And so if you're going to build a scene and have people feel like they're there and they're there with the person whose point of view you want them to be there with and whose eyes you want them to see through, you pick those details. So it's two things going on, which is to know what those details are and then try to think of, well, what would your character care about? What would he notice?
Exactly. It seems to me that in addition to all those colors and details, you're capturing this huge swath of American speech mm-hmm. from newsies who are making up versions of their headlines to shout in the streets mm-hmm. To the rich, the moneyed classes mm-hmm. of black aristocracy mm-hmm. and how they develop their very pure American dignified mm-hmm. speech. And you give us the opportunity, I didn't know it, to learn what high off the hog mm-hmm. means, because mm-hmm. the rich families, the rich black families, when they became wealthy enough, mm-hmm. they wouldn't eat the offal. They wouldn't eat the intestine.
Yeah.
They'd eat high off the hog. Mm-hmm. Amazing. Mm-hmm. How do you get that stuff?
You dig a lot. You read fiction that was written in the day. Some of it's not very good, but it is fiction, and people are at least paying attention to what's going on.
What did you read? Tell me.
I read Dreiser, which was kind of like running through syrup. A lot of Jack London, Stephen Crane, who was down in Cuba. I read Kate Chopin, who was really fun for me because I'd never read her read before. There's a good book by a guy named Chestnut, which is about the Wilmington riot. Mm-hmm. And then there's a book by Thomas Dixon, who later wrote The Klansman, which Birth of a Nation is based on, called The Leopard Spots, which is also about that incident. And so the two sides, an African-American and a racist but really intelligent American evangelical leader writing novels about the same incident. And then you read newspapers, you read letters home. And one thing that's important is that your characters don't all express themselves in the same way. And that's one of the ways that they separate themselves from each other, and that the reader is able to in a chapter that may have five of your 48 or 49 characters in it, separate the characters from each other.
Now, let me tell you, I've read all your other fiction, mm-hmm. but this is the best. Mm-hmm. Were you feeling as you were writing, hey, I'm getting it right, this is really working?
Really, as I was writing it was expanding so much that I was just trying to keep up with it. Quite honestly, I at some point had to just forget about structure and just follow the story of each of the characters and then go back and think about structure. So the exciting part was that the characters were getting into interesting stuff, and I was seeing connections in the research but also just in my writing that I didn't know were going to be there.
Because I feel when you're reading this that you're feeling like a writer feeling proud of himself and having a good time, mm-hmm. then a better time, and then the best time.
Yeah, it was really fun to write. And some of it is that very thing of not worrying too much about the structure at first. Where you're feeling like, oh, God, well, I've got to rein this in. So I definitely went down some places that were very interesting and wrote some nice things that aren't in the book. But I at least got to do that because I said, well, once you're over about 400 pages, you're not talking about a finely structured little page turner anymore. You're talking about the star is the era. And there are a lot of people who are taking us through the era, and there's some important things that are going to happen in it. But I don't have to worry about, oh, I haven't seen this character for 57 pages, so he better show up again.
Now, I think this is a very important book, and the thought of editors turning it down without writing you letters of extraordinary condolence seems very horrifying to me, because we need this kind of book. It's American history mm-hmm. told from the point of view of the people who don't get to tell it, mm-hmm. from a writer who's taking on all sorts of dangerous voices and doing dangerous things. Mm-hmm. Writers don't feel that they are safe, white writers doing a black voice. Mm-hmm. We don't even feel safe doing a voice outside our sexual preference.
That's interesting. I think I missed that. I've been doing it for so long. The very act of writing is pretentious. Unless you're writing autobiographically, you are pretending to know what another character is thinking or doing or why they're doing it. You start that, and you don't have to go very far from yourself to be pretending. You're also pretending that you have something you know, in toto that a reader is going to want to read or should know about. So I've just been doing it, you know, so long that I think I missed it. You know, I'm not really from the book world. I don't come out with a book every 2 years. I come out with one every 15 years or more. So whatever that thing about you're not supposed to write this and you should really only write about yourself, you know, I just missed it. You know, it's just these characters are too interesting to leave alone.
Presses like McSweeney's are forming a kind of successionist movement. They're saying, if it's good enough, we're going to publish it, mm-hmm. and we're going to prove that if it's good enough, we can make money on it, mm-hmm. that it's worth, that people want to read what's worthwhile, mm-hmm. that we've been lied to mm-hmm. about questions of readers and writing, that mm-hmm. publishers have been responsible. They were responsible for not being in on the net from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. They're literary people. Who were they not to keep up with trends? Mm-hmm. And if they're losing now, it's a cause of short-sightedness, it mm-hmm. seems to me. Can you speak a bit about finding a small press?
You know, I think the big thing that happened in the movie business as well as the book business is it corporatized. And when something corporatized, generally that means is that books aren't their only business and that they're starting to look at spreadsheets and numbers instead of books. And when the thing itself isn't your business, you just look at it and you say, well, why is it worth, you know, the profit margin on this thing is so low. Why is it worth our effort? Why is it, you know, I've got so many things to do. Why do I even have to read this for a half an hour? It's if the upside of it is just this much profit. Whereas if books are the only thing you do and it's what you want to do and you can figure out a way, okay, I can have 10 employees and run a small publishing thing and none of us are going to get rich. And if we do, it's some windfall that we never, you know, should expect to happen again. You can publish books. At least now you still can. But you're going to have to work hard at it. And you're never going to get rich. And that's just not what a corporation is set up to do.
Well, thank you, John Sayles. You've written a wonderful book, a major book, a thrilling book, and I'm glad to have been able to talk to you.
Thank you.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from A Moment in the Sun published by McSweeney's at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.